produced by Jeffrey Grisellius, Joseph Cottrell and Ken Fuller. This is Yes Music Podcast episode 619. Chris Squire, Basslines We Love.
Hi, this is Trevor Rabin and you're listening to the Yes Podcast.
Welcome to episode 619 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along in a few minutes' time. You can always get involved with the podcast via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week would have been Chris Squire's 76th birthday. To celebrate his legacy, Mark and I chose three of our favourite Squire bass lines and also chatted about his signature sound and how he achieved it. Make sure you add your own selections to the comments on the show notes for this episode, and let's celebrate the legacy of the world's greatest bassist together. Activity in the extended world of Yes was once again frenetic this week. In the YMP Facebook discussion group, Ken Fuller shared the Rock on Tours podcast episode featuring Steve Howe, which is a great listen. And Hector Salvador Plaza added photos of Steve in the spotlight on the Going for the One tour, and John Anderson live as well. H.B. Peterson spotted the latest Bill Bruford edition on YouTube. This time it's a wonderful video of ABWH at Mountain View, California. And Stephen and Dan Schinder's Yes Shift celebrates Chris Squire's birthday and an interview with Derek Shulman from Gentle Giant. Stephen Lamb's Winter's End Progressive Rock Festival is on the 11th and 12th of April in Chepstow this year and will feature some wonderful acts, including Oliver Wakeman showcasing his new album, Anam Cara. And Miguel Falcao has released his latest bass cover, Guess What It Is. Ray Reithmeyer shares Goldmine magazine's ranking of Chris Squire Yes songs, and Brian Sullivan added the 2010 video of John Anderson performing State of Independence with the Cleveland Youth Orchestra. John Pickles showed off his ABWH 10-inch Brother of Mine single, and the aforementioned Stephen Lamb added another podcast interview of Steve Howe. This time, it's on the Word in Your Ear show. H.P. Peterson was back with a new back-to-back remix of Owner of a Lonely Heart, released recently. And Jeffrey Mason's list this week included a 1969 poster advertising the original Yes band lineup supporting the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, also with Roy Harper, at Sunderland Empire. A 1998 review and interviews from the Bournemouth concert printed in The Guardian, and a report of the February the 28th, 1984, 90125 album tour rehearsal at Millersville University's Puchillo, is that how you pronounce it, gymnasium, from The Snapper. Doug Curran's list contained Remembering Chris Squire with his photos across the years. The remarkable news, also reported by H.P. Peterson, that John Anderson and the Band Geeks are to release a 9-track album of brand new songs later this year, called True, according to Yes chronicler Henry Potts. Footage from 1971 of Yes and Stephen Stills in a London TV studio, which is a pilot for a show called Take One Plus One. News of an event featuring John Anderson and the Band Geeks called Yes, Epics, Classics and More, with Welcome Back, The Return of Emerson, Lake and Palmer, which features Keith Emerson and Greg Lake from the Royal Albert Hall and Carl Palmer and his band live in sync and playing all together. Okay. A photo of Billy Sherwood, a.k.a. The Mayor, apparently, rehearsing for Cruise to the Edge with Dave Kersner, and another with Billy, Steve Hackett and Fernando Perdomo. And a photo reminding us that 11 years ago yesterday, Peter Banks died at the tragically young age of 65. Do check out the comments on the show notes from last week, where Alan Williams discovered some of the filming locations for the Brother of Mine video we talked about, and also pointed out it was directed by Hypnosis's Storm Thorgerson. And H.P. Peterson said he didn't see it at all on European MTV. Aaron Steelman says that Steve Wilson says he hasn't paid attention to Yes since Big Generator. Oh. And Jeremy North refers to the previous week's episode saying, at the time, Fripp and Gabriel were working together. I remember seeing Mr. Fripp on Peter Gabriel's early tours, playing but slightly off stage sitting on a stool. Those were most definitely the days. So thank you to everyone who's been in contact in any way this week.
Yes Music Podcast, 12 True Summers.
Mark is with me now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing today?
Not too bad. Yourself?
Not too bad. Things are looking nice out here today. It's supposed to be a sunny, no clouds, and plus 12, so can't complain.
We've both chosen three of our favourite Chris Squire bass lines. I mean, every single song has a wonderful Chris Squire bass line on it, pretty much. But we've chosen three of our favourites. And before we do that, I very much enjoyed watching a little overview of Chris Squire's bass technique, part of the Bass Habits YouTube channel. And yeah, so it's called How to Play Like Chris Squire of Yes, Bass Habits episode 55. And I thought it was a really nice overview. I mean, it doesn't go into the kind of detail that Miguel Falcao has helped us to go into a lot of times, but a few nice points that this person makes. And I'll put the YouTube video into the show notes for this week over at yesmusicpodcast.com. So what he said was, to begin with, Chris Squire had a signature sound, which he calls the foundation of Yes's sonic appeal. He said that Chris had a fearless force in their live spectacles, definitely agree with that, developed a playing style that had not existed before, and had a sense of syncopation and counterpoint. So the first thing that he talked about was how Chris got his tone. And he said that that was a combination of using a pick rather than your fingers, although Chris obviously did all these things at some point. But anyway, his basic sound, the pick, round wound strings, which is one of the things I want to ask you about in a moment, and his Rickenbacker, his trademark Rickenbacker bass guitar. So tell us about round wound strings. Tell us about strings, bass strings and guitar strings, and the differences between them and what difference that makes to the sound.
Well, there's two types of strings, basically, for electric bass, at least. There's round wound strings and there's flat wound strings. Flat wound strings were pretty much the standard back in the, 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s. I think it was 60s, 70s. And they were very, like, just think of early Beatles, like McCartney, when his bass is kind of like, very, very bottom endish, but not a lot of clarity to it.
Right.
And it's also, like R&B stuff, like James Jamerson or stuff like that. He was known for having flat wound strings. And a lot of people used flat wound strings when they didn't want to have a lot of overtones coming out of the bass guitar.
Yeah.
Like, because if you put on a brand new pack of bass strings and you play it through an amp, you'll hear a lot of every little movement on the string, you'll hear all kinds of stuff will happen
because of the
newness of the round wound, right?
Okay.
So the flat wound tend to stay away from that. So the round wound strings are very much a part of his sound because, as we all know, the big part of Chris Squire's sound was the top end from it.
Yes, yes. And just the terminology has always confused me, round wound versus flat wound. So that's actually the construction, the way the string is constructed, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, if you look at a round wound string, there's like edgings on the string, right? If you were to rub your finger on the string, you'll feel like an edge, right?
Mm.
But whereas the flat wound strings are, it looks like just like a flat piece of wire. Like it's just like very smooth and there's no edge to it, right?
Right. So that reminds me, so the flat round, can't say it. Flat wound ones remind me very much more of string bass. So a classical bass.
Yes, yes.
Would be more of those, and then the electric more of the round with the, as you say. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? When you say that there are kind of ridges on a round wound string, that you would get a very different sound. So yes, this chap, I should have found out his name, but I'll have to just call him this guy. He said that Chris Squire's special tone combined with an aggressive pick attack and machine-like precision was one of the ways that he got his sound. And he talked about that picking technique. He used apparently Chris Squire used a Herco, which is just a brand, heavy gauge pick. And this is something which again, Chris eventually explained what was going on. He developed this technique of not just plucking the string with the pick. He also had his thumb behind. And there's an amazing YouTube video, I'm sure you've seen it, Mark, where he explains and and demonstrates what happens. Mm. So this, you know, we've got the strings, we've got the pick and the way that he played it, but also using his thumb in addition to the pick introduced more harmonics into the sound. So the Rickenbacker is famous, as we've spoken to Miguel about many times. The Rickenbacker itself is famous for having a bright sound, or being able to produce a bright sound. You've then got these round strings, which makes it brighter. The fact that Chris turned the treble all the way up when he was playing. Mm-hmm. And also this technique of introducing harmonics, which is a parallel, apparently, according to the video that I watched, to pinch harmonics. So we're going to have to rely on you again, Mark. Pinch harmonics, what are those?
Pinch harmonics are just like this kind of sound that you get when you strike the string with the pick. You kind of put a little bit of your thumb skin against it, and it does like this high-pitched like sound as you strike it. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like you're hitting two notes at once, right?
Yeah.
I remember on the video, because I know exactly the video you're talking about. It's a Chris Squire instructional video, in fact.
Yes, yes.
Right? And he said it's almost like doing a doubling effect, right? Mm. Like where the second note comes like a 1/1,000,000th of a second after the other one, right? And it's very interesting, because it's very rare that bass players do that. It's pretty more known for guitar players to kind of do that kind of stuff, right? Mm. Where they do that kind of thing, and they call it squawking, where it kind of just does the sound like wah, like it does this really high noise. Who had like Zakk Wylde and all these guitar players were known for doing that, right? But for on bass, it's not very common to do that. And also another thing, you talked about that Herco pick that he uses. That pick is a nylon pick, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And those ones are, you know, I've played nylon ones before, and I find they're good for me for acoustic guitar, not so much electric. Because they add a kind of texture to the sound as well, I find. Right. So that's very possible that those picks did add a little something, like, you know, 2% of the overall sound maybe came from that too.
Right? Yeah. Well, the most famous, I suppose, or one of the most famous examples of the pick making a big difference to a sound is Brian May, isn't it? He uses old-fashioned sixpences, which I think he has specially made nowadays, now that they've gone out of circulation. And that gave his Red Special guitar a particular sound. But just going back for a second, I promise I'll stop going on about this in a minute. So these pinch harmonics, so this reminds me very much of style of guitar playing in the 80s, where bands, I don't know, like Van Halen or whoever, had this squawking sound that you talk about. And it's very, once you've heard it, you can't forget it, can you? It sounds as if they're trying to play a particular note in a run or whatever on the guitar solo, but in fact when the note speaks, it's a couple of octaves above where it should be, and that I think is the idea.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and it was very popularized in the 80s, you know, any kind of 80s metal or hard rock band you can think of, their guitar players all did that. So, you know, I could list them probably a million guitar players that have done it, but it's something that kind of went out of fashion a little bit in the 90s.
Yeah.
But then it, you know, it's come back again. I mean, everything comes full circle.
Yeah. Yeah. So exactly as you said on this video that I watched, he said that Chris Squire approached the bass more like a guitar player than a bassist. And that's one of the reasons why his playing was unique. Now, something else that he did to it after, you know, playing with it, the sound itself, and again, we've talked at length with Miguel about exactly what these effects were, but he used effects, again, more commonly used by guitarists. So the crybaby wah-wah pedal, distortion, chorus, flanger, and if you want to go into great detail about what he used for Tormato, you can, of course, read my book about it.
Yes.
So always looking for different sounds from the bass guitar, and, you know, that made his approach unique. So explain to us then why some of these weren't traditionally used by bass guitarists. So why weren't they interested in adding things like that wah-wah effect or distortion or chorus? Why would bassists not have been interested in those sorts of approaches?
Well, I mean, for the longest time, bass guitars were kind of looked at as like a backing instrument, not really something that was ever in the forefront of the music, right? I mean, it was always looked at like the drums and bass were the rhythm section and they were in the back and the guitar was kind of a little bit more in the front, right? Along with the singer, right? And these effects mainly were created for guitar players, you know, anyway, slice it. That's really where they started because like the Crybaby Wah pedal was something that was developed back in the 60s and people like Jimi Hendrix used it a lot and Jimmy Page and stuff like that, right? And then everybody and their brother used the Wah pedal after a while. distortion was used just to get the sound more power or more grind to it, right? And the chorus pedal, was used to give the mainly the clean tones, kind of a more shimmering, glassy sound to it, right? And the big thing with the chorus pedals were that they were one of the first things that were developed to where you can plug in mono, like one chord, right? And the output you can go left, right, stereo, so it would make a really wide stereo sound for your guitar, right? And this, of course, we know is something that Chris Squire likes doing, is doing two separate sounds, one distorted and one sort of clean sound, and he intermixes it to make his sound, right? So I don't think that he necessarily used a chorus for that purpose, but it could have definitely helped if he wanted to do a simplified version of his rig. But, you know, the wah pedal, he used it quite a bit. Like, listen to the bass solo in The Fish on the Yes Songs album, right?
Yes.
I mean, he does use it, and you can hear, like, wah, 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 when he does those little sections in there. He's using it a lot, right? And it became one of these things that bass players who are daring enough to use it did use it. Like, I know there's a band called Metallica, which I'm sure you've heard of. Their first bass player, Cliff Burton, had a wah pedal through distortion, and he had a bass solo on his first album called Anesthesia Pulling Teeth. And it's basically, he had this wah sound through distortion, and it was really, really interesting. Like, it was something that nobody had really heard to that extreme at that point, right? This is 1983, don't forget, right? So, so the pedals were something that, just to make this simple, The pedals were normally looked at as something that guitar players used and not very commonly for bass players. So as soon as people like Chris Squire and this and these people started using it, they immediately gave themselves a sort of more signature sound because of it.
Yes, absolutely. And I suppose all of this was contributing to the fact that Chris wanted the bass to be sort of reinvented, wasn't it? So as you were saying, it's not in the background anymore. It's not necessarily providing the bass of the music when Chris is playing, because he plays so high up on the neck so often. And yes, he wanted to reinvent it, and reinvent it as an equal partner, I suppose, to the lead guitar. He wanted to do something different. So the last part of this video explained a little bit about the way he put together bass lines, which I was absolutely fascinated by. And as soon as you start looking out for these, as I did when I looked for my three lines that we'll come on to in a moment, they are very obvious. So Chris's style would be ascending lines. So runs or patterns which ascend up the neck of the guitar. And he said that very much suited the Yes aesthetic. So we're looking for a bright, an epic flavour, etc. And apparently, I've not investigated this yet, perhaps I should, he says this is the opposite of a band like Pink Floyd, whose descending lines gave a darker, a moodier, and a less positive vibe to some of their music. And he also uses 16th note runs, which I think we call quavers over the side of the Atlantic. So very fast playing, which perhaps wasn't very common. Syncopation, and again, this ascending modulation. So what he means by that is playing a particular pattern on the bass guitar and then shifting your hand up, playing the same pattern, but then keep shifting it up and up to get a different effect and to modulate the key or whatever. And finally, before we go into the songs we've chosen, underpinning the vocal parts. So he constructed his bass lines so that they would sort of weave in and out of what John Anderson was singing in the vocal part. And of course, Chris was also singing backing vocals at the same time. So are those features that you can instantly recognize?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are all things that are signature to Chris Squire. I mean, all these things that you mentioned, I mean, when I hear them, I immediately think of Chris Squire.
Yeah.
And then absolutely. All the kind of people that he influenced throughout the years later on, they're evident in their sound as well, like Geddy Lee, for example,
yes.
Right?
Yes, absolutely right. And John Deacon, apparently, according to this video, very taken with what Chris Squire was doing. And yes, and Queen shared the bill several times in their early days. All right, so let's go on to the three songs that we've chosen. And I've been banging on quite a bit, so let's start with your first choice, Mark.
Okay, so I kind of did them from 3 to 1. Like, not that, number one is the almightiest line of all time, but just they're my favorites, right?
Yeah.
So I did do 3 and then a backup for each one, just in case you pick one of the ones
that I want.
So I do have a backup. So I'll go with my first one
here,
and that is Tempest Fugit.
Ah, right, yes.
Now, this one, I think, to me, was immediately one of these lines that hit me right away, because... First of all, Drama was an album I came to late in the whole Yes catalog.
Yes.
But when I heard it the first time, I was like, wow, what's going on here? And this is one of those examples that we were just talking about earlier, where there's some chorusing effect on his bass going on. He does that sort of running up the neck there. Do, 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 do. He's going up the neck, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Up the scale, at least, right?
Yes.
Doing that. And the thing that's also something that I think people sometimes overlook with this, what makes this line so fantastic is that he's doing this line do 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 in the verse, but he's also singing during that. So try just playing that line alone could be tricky, but singing on top of that with it, I mean, that just makes this bass line fantastic, you know?
Absolutely. It's a very enjoyable. That's the thing about Drama. I find the whole album really enjoyable from start to finish. There's very little space to get bored.
Yes.
Not that I usually do get bored with Yes music, but there's always something exciting happening on that record.
Yeah, definitely.
Brilliant. That's a great first choice. Well, let's go for my first choice. I've actually gone in chronological order, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. And I always choose this bass line because it's the it's the start of everything. So it's Beyond and Before, which is the first song on the first Yes album. And I always choose this because, in a way, it's staggering that really the first sounds you hear of Yes are Chris Squire's bass. And I actually, as you might remember, I started learning the bass guitar, and this was the first song that I ever started learning. And I went from Miguel Falcao's cover version of it, his bass cover, which is wonderful because you can see exactly what Chris Squire was doing, focusing on the left hand and the right hand and what's happening. And it always strikes me as this is a statement, really, that Yes music is going to be something different. You start with this really, really high, it's almost as high as you can possibly go on the bass guitar, with these repeated notes at the beginning of Beyond and Before. But also as it goes on, it's very much a counter-melodic line. It's always mobile and lots of very high playing. You can definitely, if you listen, I won't be able to listen to a Chris Squire bass line without looking out for those things that we've just mentioned now. Definitely the ascending modulation, a certain pattern, and then shifted up. And yes, interweaving line with the Banks soloing towards the end. And I do love the end of this song as well, because it fades away and everything's getting really quiet, and then it suddenly crashes at the end. It's just such a fun song, and I also love playing it. So yes, a classic Chris Squire, very early bass line.
Yeah, that's definitely a very strong bass playing example. And I mean, like you said, what a way to start off the whole Yes catalog is, you know, with Chris Squire come roaring through your speakers right off the bat, right? So it also has some of those things that we talked about earlier too. I mean, it has a touch of distortion on there too, right?
So it
does start introducing these little elements in there early on.
Absolutely, great. Have you got a second one then?
I sure do. My second one is one that whenever I go and do bass playing on my own record, I like to just warm up with little things here and there. Hmm. And I always tried playing this, and I can play it, but what I find is that it's tricky because he doesn't play the same pattern all the time. And this is Heart of the Sunrise when he does that do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Yeah.
Do. Every once in a while at the end of the line, he'll change note. Do, 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 and then he won't do the same thing all the time. So if you're following along, you're like, oh, I missed that note. Oh, I missed that note. You know? So it's a really tricky bass line. And even the whole beginning of it, too. That I mean, it's not the most easiest bass line to do. And if you think about it, it's very much something that back in 71, 72, when they did this, not a lot of bass players were doing these kind of runs, I don't think. I mean, I can't remember many bass players that were doing that active of bass playing in a song. I mean, sure, maybe there are sections of stuff here and there, but I think Chris Squire was very much heralded as an innovator of this sort of playing.
I couldn't agree more. And one of the things which you really find remarkable about Billy Sherwood is that he's able to replicate this, these Chris Squire lines, the backing singing, but the complexity of them. You're absolutely right. So that reminds me of that. I have also tried to learn Run with the Fox. And that, again, seems like a simple bass line in places, but there is so much variation, even in that 3 minute piece. There is so much variation in the patterns and little tricks and things that you know that he's thrown in just to make it more interesting for himself to play. And I think that's the key to it. He's not really fulfilling a role. And someone like John Deacon, I mean, wonderful, wonderful bass player and some of the greatest lines ever written. But he didn't like being center stage, did he? He didn't like being a lead bass player at all. But Chris, just the way he constructs the bass lines, you could always tell that he was trying to keep it interesting and keep the bass line, as I say, as a parallel and as an equal partner to any guitar lines or vocal lines or keyboard lines. And again, we've talked about it recently, the combination, the rhythm section of Bruford Squire and then White Squire, just producing these amazing combinations. Wonderful stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely think that, for example, when you talked about Deacon there, I mean, one of the lines that's come up right away to my mind where he's like in the very rare situation where he is front and center, it's like Another One Bites the Dust. But if you think about it, if Chris Squire were to have played that, it probably would have been like he probably would have added some other notes into it.
Yes.
Because it's very much more simplistic a line that he did, right? I have a feeling that he was playing that bass line with the band, full band, and then he probably just decided, wait a minute, what would it sound like if it was just drums and bass first?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's kind of dropped out the guitar and therefore you had the beginning. So I mean his playing is so let's put it this way. He was never afraid to step into the spotlight with his playing.
Yeah. Well, that's a fantastic segue onto my second song, which is You Won't Be Surprised to Hear from Tormato on the Silent Wings of Freedom. And yes, this is really only one of several occasions where he really did step up to be center, to be in the spotlight. And yeah, perhaps it's very telling that recent performances of this have just missed out this first part of On the Silent Wings of Freedom for a particular reason, and it's because it's an actual bass solo at the beginning of a song. How many songs are there out there which start with a bass solo? Can't be many. Certainly I was blown away the first time I heard it, that's for sure. And, you know, I've got some quotes here from my own book, which is really quite a strange thing to do, isn't it? But anyway, I'm quoting myself. I said in the book that I regarded this as some of the best drums and bass interplay in all Yes music and a masterclass in the bass guitarist's art. Now, what he manages to do with this is create a huge, an enormous forward motion with this. And there is quite a bit of contrast within this song as well of bass playing. So there's a meditative, explorative theme leading to that bit where the church bell comes in. And that's in the same song as all those fireworks, those amazing fireworks at the beginning. And I described the end, the finish, properly excessive with Squire jumping in to make sure we all remember that he is also capable of adding complex, fast-moving and energetic lines. It's a real tour de force, isn't it, on the Silent Wings of Freedom?
Yeah, it's such a great example of his bass playing. And once again, we have examples of a sort of chorusing effect. We have an example of the wah pedal in there at the beginning with it as well. And we have also examples of something else that he liked to do that most bass players didn't do very often, is putting in little chords and arpeggios into his playing, right? Yes. Like when he does that one line, he does like this three-note chord on the string, on the bass, like, wow, like that's not something that you do too often. And one of the things that's where the wah pedal comes in handy for Chris Squire is because we talked about before how he likes to have a very top-end sound. Yes. A wah pedal is essentially a foot-sweepable equalizer almost, where it goes through certain frequencies. Like when you push it down, it gets more trebly. When you pull it all the way up, it goes very bottomy, like very like this, right? So you can find little frequencies in there, and it can be very helpful, because if you're looking for a sound to cut through, let's say, some keyboard sounds that are taking up a lot of space, you can push the pedal down and find a frequency where it'll cut through. And that's, I think, what that's he did good. That a lot with his bass playing there.
Fabulous. All right, let's go on to your third one then, Mark.
All right, so my number one, I kind of threw a dice between the two that I had. But I'm going to go with the one that I think will make the most sense to people who have listened to this fine podcast for as long as they have, from the beginning almost that I've been involved with it, know that my favorite album is Relayer. Yeah. So Sound Chaser, of course, would be my favorite bass line. And I mean, I think that a more signature bass line to Chris Squire, I don't think you could probably think of than that. I mean, that whole do 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 do, that whole line in there. It's fantastic. Even the section before Steve Howe's guitar solo is great. That down. Like, it's so quick and so precise, his playing in the song. Yeah. And it's one of those workouts for a bass player where when you're done playing it, you're probably like, you know, blistered fingers like crazy.
Yes, absolutely right. And also when you're the drummer.
Yes.
I'm sure you have blistered fingers. I'm the guitarist and everybody's got blistered fingers in that one. Yes, it is it's an amazing, amazing piece of work. And some of the fastest playing and most intricate playing of all Yes music. And we've already mentioned very different types of bass lines in those ones. And I'm going to go completely to a different style of bass playing, and I've chosen Changes. And the reason, not from 90125. And so this is, as I say, a very, very different mode of Squire bass playing. And probably this bass line, or possibly this bass line, originated from Trevor Rabin. Trevor Rabin may have put it together in the first place, as he had such a major part of writing 90125 and the songs there. So perhaps it's not in origin Chris Squire, but certainly Chris adds his own touches to it, of course. So he replicates the opening, that odd time signature pattern that you've got at the beginning of Changes, which is played on some kind of piano or marimba or keyboard or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And that's replicated by the drums and the bass and the lead guitar as well. And Miguel Falcao, miguelbass.com, have a look over there at his bass cover of Changes, because he plays it on an 8-string bass. And so there's Chris again, trying to find new ways of playing bass lines. And so that bass has got 2 octaves, hasn't it? So each pair of strings is in octaves. And so that gives a really different feel and different sound to this bass line as well. So there are, and I do recommend that you watch that, because you can see where he shifts the whole pattern down an octave, as we were talking about earlier, in terms of using the same pattern but down an octave or up an octave. And it's a steady pattern ostinato against the guitar. It is quite a fast pattern in itself, but it's definitely not the kind of Squire bass line that we've talked about so far. I mean, there are even sort of single notes, but it all fits the song perfectly, I think. There's a lot more space in this, but when he does play, you know, it's in exactly the right place and the right mode. One thing I noticed, though, was that there's a quick riff figure in there, which is almost the same as the start of To the Moment. If you think about the pattern there, that's almost replicated from Changes. He does some harmony figures against the piano, and even though it's a more sparse bass line, I still think that it's really dramatic in the context of that and that song. And traditionally, as we've said before, just a few minutes ago, he likes to spice things up, and so he puts in little passages of eighth or sixteenth notes, that's quavers and semiquavers and those sorts of things, in there to just make it a bit more interesting for himself and for the listener. And I think it shows his mastery of, and it's a bit of a parallel, isn't it, to Alan White's drumming, as opposed to the Bill Bruford jazz influence that, but what really comes to the fore with that whole rhythm section, Squire and White, is that they know exactly what to put in for the context of the song. So yes, Squire was always looking to be in the spotlight, but it depends on the context of the song, and what he chooses is perfect. So there we are, Changes.
So Changes is definitely one of those bass playing lines that Chris Squire once again went down some new avenues, again with the 8-string bass, which is something that I don't think that he did very often in his playing. And it definitely gives you a distinctive sound. One thing that was very interesting too is when you look back to Awaken, when he had the triple neck bass, he had a sort of 8-string setup there with that shorter scale bass. But instead of having octaves, he actually did harmonized strings on that.
Yes.
So you can use the 8-string in a very much more adventurous way than just having it in octaves. But the octaves is probably the best way to do it, because it can really reinforce a riff when you do like that. Like that whole thing. I mean, my old bass player in my band that I was in when I was in Piledriver, he had an 8-string bass that he started playing later on in our touring cycle. And he used to always say that he loved playing it because it was almost like having another guitar player in the band. Yes. Because not only did you have a low string, but you had this other high string in there, so that whenever I did a guitar solo, it almost still sounded like there was another guitar player playing along as well. Having an 8-string bass can have its advantages, definitely, in there. And, you know, I think that he did that as well because we were talking about before 90125 how they didn't want to totally abandon the progressive nature of the band, right? So what better way to kind of add in a little bit of reminder of progginess in there than to have maybe an 8-string bass?
Yeah, I think it works brilliantly on that piece. So just tell us, from interest's point of view, what were your backup songs?
Ah, okay. So my backup number 3 song was Silent Wings of Freedom, which was one that you did. So I'm glad that I had that as a backup, because now, you know, in case you didn't come up with it, but I knew for sure that you would bring that one up. I mean, yeah, we're talking the man who worships and loves Tormato, so of course he would bring it up, right?
Yeah.
The backup for Heart of Sunrise I had was a Roundabout.
Yeah.
Right? Which is definitely a signature bass playing sound.
Yeah.
And my backup number 1, and this is the one I was kind of unsure about which one I was going to put number 1, is Hold Out Your Hand. Because I always thought that was such an important bass line, because on that record, there's so little guitar on that album. It's really bass, organ, orchestra, and drums, right?
Yes. Wonderful stuff.
So, yeah, I love that bass line.
Wonderful, wonderful stuff. And as I said at the beginning, there are just so many of those bass lines, and it's spoiled me. I've mentioned that before as well, that whenever I listen to any kind of music, actually, whether it's classical or rock music or pop music or whatever, I always latch onto the bass line and compare it to a Chris Squire bass line. And often it's found wanting, not just because of the complexity, but the ability that he had to, as I say, choose just the right sound, just the right pattern for the context of the music. Right, well, those are our choices, so don't leave it at that, please. Come in and comment on the show notes for this week's episode and tell us what your favourite Chris Squire bass lines are and why. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
This is Two Pence with Mark Anthony Kay and Kevin Mulrine.
Mark is still here, and we're going to have a Two Pence, which is the first time for quite a long time. And this is because we've just heard this week that a new CD, a 9-track CD, has been created by John Anderson and the Band Geeks. And as far as we understand it at the moment, this is brand new music, which is really quite remarkable. So the Two Pence sort of topic is this a good idea? So, Mark, what do you think?
There was always that saying before that, you know, there's nothing wrong with having more new music. You know what I mean? Unless they come up with like another Heaven and Earth, I mean, which I don't think that's going to happen with these guys. Right.
No.
But I mean, I'm kind of excited about it because we clearly know that John Anderson is very, you know, willing and able to sing still. And I'm sure he has tons of different lyrics and stuff like that. And the one thing that gets me really excited about this is that Richie Castellano is such a great guitar player, bass player, multi-instrumentalist. But not only that, but he's also very good at recording. I mean, if you listen to all those performances that they do on their channel, I mean, he mixed and mastered a lot of those things himself, right?
Mm-hmm.
On there. And he's, you know, he did a lot of the production work on these things, you know, whether it was finding, you know, different effects on vocals and stuff like that. Like when you listen to how he does some of the backing vocals on these songs, they sound fantastic. So yeah. I can only imagine what kind of fantastic stuff they can come up with. But the key, of course, I think is going to be that they'll have to kind of, I'm not saying that they have to put their foot down or anything like that, but I think that they'll have to kind of steer John, because we know how John can be. You know, he has a lot of ideas that are, you know, willy-nilly sometimes, or sometimes he gets on something really good. I think they have to keep him on track, I think, you know, make sure that he stays the course. I mean, all the records that we love, the producers have always said that as long as they kept John in line and kept him, you know, focused on a certain path when it comes lyrically and stuff, then it was always good.
Yes, indeed. The question in my mind is, what kind of music are we talking about here? The whole time that the Band Geeks have been working with John Anderson, they have gone out of their way to play epics, and that's what the show is called, isn't it? And concentrating on the progressive output of Yes and John himself over the years. So it would be very strange, wouldn't it, if this came out as a collection of very, very different songs. If this came out as a collection along the lines of A Thousand Hands, that would be odd, I think, because quite a bit of that album, and I quite like that album, but quite a bit of it is towards the end of sort of spacey, fun, quirky John Anderson pop songs. So it won't be that, will it?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that when you now say John Anderson and the Band Geeks, I mean, most people immediately think, oh, great, we're going to have like a lot of these epic songs that, you know, don't get played that much anymore live in this show. So maybe their idea is to do a couple of new epics for John, that he can play. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there was a couple of 5-minute songs or 6-minute songs in there.
Yeah, of course.
I mean,
I'm
not expecting all of them to be 18 minutes long, right?
No.
but I definitely think that they're going to be doing very progressive music, and I definitely think they're going to be doing very much songs in the epic style.
Yeah. I mean, there are already people getting concerned about using the three-letter word as part of the marketing or, you know, the production of this this album. And inevitably it will be compared with Mirror to the Sky, because that's the latest Yes album. But it's going to be absolutely fascinating to see what it is. The other thing that John Anderson has been doing is sneaking YouTube videos out without really any fanfare at all. And there are a lot of them, some of them have been new, but quite a few of them have been just re-releases of older songs or older material. But the new ones, I always listen to them and I always think, what did they, for me, fall into the category of what Rick Wakeman was doing when he was doing his sort of easy listening type, new age type things.
Yeah.
And they're just a bit, I don't know what the word is, a bit middle of the road, John Anderson, as it were. Mm. So hopefully this, with the influence of the Band Geeks in there, this music will turn out to be a bit more, I don't know, edge, spirit, something like that, epic feel to it.
Yeah, I think the word you were looking for was razzmatazz.
Oh, yes, that'll do.
I definitely think that because, and this is not a slight to John in any way, so please no tomatoes. I think that because they're definitely much younger than John, I think they're definitely going to have a lot more energy and get-go and excitement to it because, you know, the last thing I think that they thought was going to happen like 4 years ago or 5 years ago was that they're going to make a record with John Anderson, let alone play with him.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah.
So I think that, you know, Richie's been playing with Blue Oyster Cult for a long time now, so he does understand what it's like to be in a big active touring band.
Yes.
He knows what it's like to be on records too, or to do records now that are with a bigger band. So he's going to have that, you know, experience with him to take in with this. And I think it's going to go good. I have a feeling that it's going to be a good record.
Brilliant. Well, to combine that with the latest two Yes records would be fabulous if it turns out to be really good, and there's no reason why it shouldn't be. So fingers crossed very much for that. have your say on that, of course, as always, on the show notes for this week. But for the moment, once again, thank you very much, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
Yes Music Podcast, 600 episodes.
Just before we go, as usual, here are the YMP producers and half the patrons. The producers are Joseph Cottrell, Ken Fuller and Jeffrey Cresselius. And half of those Yes Music Podcast patrons are Mark Baggs, John Cowan, John Parry, Dave Owen, Simon Barrow, Steve Scott, Terence Sadler, Steve Dill, Robert Naser, Fergus Cubbage, William Hayes, Jeff Bailey, Stephen Raw, Lobate Scarp, Jeffrey Mason, Dave Watkinson, Tim Stannard, Robert Vanderveer, Brian Sullivan, David Pannell, Jamie McQuinn, Miguel Falcao, Paul Tomei, Michael O'Connor, Brian Harris, HB Peterson, and Guy DeRome. If you'd like to join in and help them keep the lights on here at YMP Towers, please head over to Patreon, patreon.com/YesMusicPodcast, or just click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. We're going to be back next week with a special Yes interview. In the meantime, please do keep listening and getting involved via X, Facebook, or Instagram. So until next time, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.